Hey there, dog people of the internet. It's Sarah Stremming, the Cog Dog Coach, and this is Cog Dog Radio. Join me as I cover behavior concepts, discuss training ideas, interview experts, and explore my cases, all regarding the dogs we live and play with. Let's go. This week, I have return guest Liza Rader from Focus Dogs in British Columbia to talk to me about this game that we call Fetch and whether or not it's beneficial, if it's ever problematic, and just all of the ins and outs. Some of my feelings about this have evolved and some of them are the same. So if you've heard me talk about Fetch before, you might still want to check this one out. If you've heard Liza talk about Fetch before, you know how nuanced and complex this is going to get. Enjoy. All right. Welcome back, Liza. So we are talking today about the thing that you get attacked the most for on social media, which is quite funny given how many things that you have big opinions about. This is a little bit like I get attacked most for saying dogs should be off leash and have off leash time. And you get attacked most when you talk about silly little games of fetch with our dogs. So there are a lot of different ways that you can throw a thing and have a dog go get it and bring it back. So we are going to start. I'm going to start by asking you to operationalize fetch and we'll go from there.
Yeah. I think it's really important that we really clarify the terms. And if you're going to send me angry emails about it, that's super fine. But like, I'm going to need you to include this definition at the front. Otherwise, like I won't read past that if it's not there. So for our purposes here, fetch, we're going to refer to as like the repetitive back and forth throwing of a toy where either the dog is like throwing behaviors at, it's not sort of a learned marker system cue, and it's happening again and again and again, usually on a flat surface, but sometimes like on water. And the dog is cueing the next throw by putting the toy down or throwing the toy at you, often with something like a jacket or another device like that.
So the loop is essentially human throws thing, dog goes and gets thing, heads back in the human's general direction with thing, either spits toy at thing, or sorry, spits thing at human, or might even give it to person's hand, and then person throws it again. Really, really commonly.
It's the repetition.
Yes,
thereof.
And it happens again and again. It is not different from a dog putting the toy like in a mechanical device that then spits the toy out again. Like it is basically the same thing. So that's what we, from here forth, when you and I refer to fetch in this podcast, that's what we're talking about.
That's what we're saying. Yeah.
And that's important because there are a lot of ways to interact with the dog with retrieving and with toy play. So we will get into maybe what structured trained retrieving looks like. And we will get into other ways maybe to engage with a dog with a toy. But this thing, this repetitive action is very common amongst, I would say, not only pet owners, like still a lot of sport folks too, because what people are trying to achieve is kind of getting the dog's energy out is what my perception is. Is that your perception?
I've seen a number of things that mostly come down that can be boiled to that. And we're going to get into more details, I think, on like specifics later, but like that it is meeting a need for the dog in some way. So it's either meeting their movement needs, or it's meeting their chasing thing needs, or it's just tiring them out so that they're not screaming out the window or whatever when they come home. So the dogs like it.
Yeah. So the function for the person looks like fulfilling something that they perceive is needed in this dog.
Yes. Yeah.
I usually see it with super high energy dogs. You know, both my kind of dogs and your kind of dogs fall in here. Yeah. And let's just, mine are the herdy type and yours are the hunty type. The not that kind of hunty, but this kind of hunty type. The
are like sporting gun dogs.
Yeah, the gun dog type. And when folks find themselves with one of these dogs that they suddenly aren't sure what to do with, and it's easy for them to go be that machine, that ball throwing machine in the park after work and get some of this dog's energy out or fulfill
something in this dog. Like for the border collies, it kind of fulfills this. I really think that they have a deep need to be obsessed with something.
Yeah.
Like if you don't give them something to obsess about, they'll find it. They want
to
be.
Well, and the same thing with the gun dogs. They'll find something to explode at.
To explode at. Yeah. So like what they want to do is be explosive. And what the high intensity herding dogs want to do is be obsessive. And like this can be that puzzle piece for people.
Yeah.
And so
and it's very reinforcing for the humans.
Yeah. Like that's what I'm trying to acknowledge up front is that like, cause we're going to kind of shred this and talk about how maybe it's not serving you the ways that you might think that it is, and talk about, you know, what it can serve, et cetera. We're going to kind of shred it. But what I want to say up top is that like, I get it. I understand why people will do this. And I understand why it's so reinforcing to these humans. And I understand that they're trying to do a good thing for their dog too.
Yes, absolutely. Like the only dog that I have ever had who hasn't played almost daily fetch is my current dog.
Yeah, because I think that I stopped like with Iggy, and Iggy's 15. But my dog Kelso for sure was a big chase the frisbee dude. And then all my childhood dogs, it was my favorite thing to do was to throw the tennis ball in the backyard for my German Shepherd mix when I was a kid. And like, I remember when I got my Doberman as a kid, like she didn't want to do it. And I figured out how to teach her to do it by using two tennis balls, and was so proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing. It's a thing we do with dogs.
We used to have a huge bucket of tennis balls and a whole sea of screaming duck tollers and a tennis racket and like a half acre yard.
Mm-hmm.
It's great fun.
Okay, let's really get into it. What's wrong with it? We've just said everything that's great about it.
Yeah, it's fun.
Let's first talk about let's just start with the concept of fatigue and the physical fatigue that the dogs kind of need to land on in order for the person to feel like they did the thing.
They did the thing. So one of the things that I get the most often in my inbox is people with young, like retriever spaniel, like hump point retrieve breeds, who usually about 18 months, 2 years old, and they don't think they're meeting their needs. And then we get into the conversation about like, what all are we doing with this dog every day? And this dog is not sleeping.
Mm.
And they are running for miles every day, and they are going and going and going and going and going. And here's the thing about them is that they don't stop at that age. Like they just don't. They will go until they're basically keeling over, until they physically cannot anymore. And that's not a thing of like creating an athlete. That's not a thing of, you know, fitness. That's a thing of their brain keeps pushing them harder to continue doing the thing, because we've designed them that way. Like that's why they're like this, is because we wanted them to work very hard so that we could feed ourselves. But at some point you have to start drawing the line. And so if we see a dog who's doing something like playing fetch and they choose to lie down, often, especially with these kinds of dogs who have that sort of internal combustion engine going on, it's because they can't not. They're too hot, or they're too tired, or they're sore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're having to lay down. That, if that's happening frequently, that's very high risk for their body.
Yeah, and I'm going to rewind for just a second, because I do want to myth bust on the building an athlete piece. I did an entire episode myth busting this, but let's just bring it back home because it remains a pet peeve of mine and I still see it every day. Exercising your, say, young German Shorthair pointer more does not make them more of an athlete. They're designed to not be satisfied in exercise at all. And so you should be exercising them quite a bit because they do have very high exercise needs. And then you should be doing other things to help them to relax and to use their brain and not only their body. And the problem with these kind of high intensity fetch sessions and things like that isn't so much that you're going to make them an endurance beast, because they were already born an endurance beast. I don't know if you have seen one, for God's sake, but the gigantic rib cage to hold those lungs, the fact that they are ripped, even if they live in an apartment and they get leash walked, you can bounce a quarter off this dog and it doesn't even work out. Okay. Like mm-hmm. This is just how they're made. Like, you won't make them more or less of a supreme athlete by throwing this ball. It's the other stuff that's going on that if you throw that ball until the dog is actually physically fatigued, you need to understand what you've done here because they are not designed to be fatigued.
They're like literally they're not. They're designed to keep going and going. Uh-huh. And going and going. Like, I'm sure we've all heard, like those of us who have been in these kinds of dogs for any length of time, have heard about the dogs who have brought in cattle with a crushed skull.
Yes.
Who have pulled Canada geese out of the water with a ruptured cruciate. Like,
et cetera. Like, they
don't make good life choices.
No, because it is a survival mechanism. They are not designed to succumb to things, silly little things like getting tired. And you've even got, you know, both border collies and Labradors have an exercise-induced collapse condition that's slightly different in each breed. But like, I just have to say, I feel like there's a reason for that in those two particular breeds for it showing up. So, okay. If you are playing this until the dog is physically wrecked, you are not only potentially causing harm to their body, potentially, but also probably causing harm to their mind. We're going to get into kind of ways that you can engage in a fetch-like situation that will still be fulfilling for their mind. Because like we said, your kind of dogs, they want to explode at something. My kind of dogs want to obsess over something. We can still provide that. Like, we still can without it being problematic. And we're not just going to sit here and like say what not to do. Most of this is going to be about what to do. But kind of doing this until the dog is wrecked is something to avoid. But also something that we want to keep circling back to is that the dog not being wrecked and the dog being very amped and very pushy about another throw is the dog wanting another throw, but is not necessarily the dog needing another throw. And it's kind of your job to drive that bus as the human.
Mm-hmm. And if we think about the behavior loops that we start to get and how resilient those loops can become with that really, really, really high reinforcement on such a unpredictable, you know, delivery system. And the kind of nervous system activation that they are practicing constantly in order to get this really, really high reinforcement. The behaviors that I get so often: screaming, barking, body slamming, biting, throwing things at people, just generally being like really harassing, like through pushing it in and pushing it in and pushing it in and pushing it in, controlling movement, deking through people's legs. Like, there's so many other things, because as we're going to get into this more later, because the loops are so dirty and undefined.
Yes. Well, and because the person, we weren't being mindful about them, as well as like, we've all been at that barbecue with the dog that just keeps throwing the ball at us. Like, it's like, which one of you is going to work? Mm-hmm. Which one of you is going to work?
And it pretty much feels like once a year you get a story somewhere of an adolescent toddler drowning.
Oh my goodness.
Playing fetch. And that's actually almost happened to my dog's great grandmother. And she walked out of the water and collapsed and vomited water everywhere and had to be rushed to emerge. Like, it's, they can really, really, really hurt themselves.
This is circling back to, you have to drive the bus. You are the one with the giant frontal lobe and the credit card and the opposable thumbs. And like, you need to make the decisions for them, because they won't make good ones on their own. This is like, border collies getting water intoxication because they are biting at water. And every time they bite the water moves. So then they bite the water again. This is a big, big problem. It's why I don't play chase the hose with my border collies. I call that that's under my NFBC category, not for border collies. Guess who gets to bite the hose? Raya, my Icelandic sheepdog. You know why? Because she is like, ooh, that's fun. And then she stops. And then she moves on, and she doesn't come and try to bite the cleaner that's in a bottle that I'm just spraying the counter with and then get a mouthful of Clorox or whatever it is. Glares at certain other border collies. So, as well as, like, I don't even think Felix likes water at all. but he is obsessed with me throwing something. Yeah. And he will find a puddle.
We've been having this conversation.
He will find a puddle on a trail that is literally just like a puddle of mud that like doesn't even come up to his wrist. And he is standing in it, crouched and staring at me because he's like, you could throw something in this. And the number of times that I have thrown things, the number of times that I have thrown things is like not a lot of times because I know, but it didn't take a lot of times.
But it doesn't take a lot of times. And then you get behaviors that look like, I want you to throw the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Are they, I want you to throw the thing, or are they, I expect the thing to be thrown and I'm excited or amped that that contingency might be on the table?
Is there a difference?
Is there a difference? Sometimes there is.
And I think it's the emotional valence is where the difference lies. So when anticipation is in positive valence, which valence just means the extent to which an emotion is yucky or yummy. When anticipation is in positive valence, it's I want you to. And when anticipation is in negative valence, it is desperation. It is yucky. It can look similar, but it, I believe, is not a similar experience for them.
Well, and again, we're talking about dogs who have really big feelings about their reinforcers. So for a lot of the dogs that I work with, the reinforcer at play is not chasing the thing, it's holding the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if they get the thing by it being thrown, a lot of the dogs who come to me with toy obsession issues, when we really break down what's going on, they don't actually want the thing thrown.
Mm-hmm.
They want to hold on to it.
A lot of the time, sure.
And so you keep throwing their stuff away. And they have to go and get it. It can get so messy and so muddy, and it's really hard to pull apart for people. It's hard for, you know, it takes weeks to figure out exactly what's going on when I have a really sticky toy obsession case.
And toy obsession is something that I think you and I could jam on for like its own entire 2 hours, because I would say that the really sporty border collies have been selected to have more toy possession so that they will play better with toys. You don't have to actually work hard to teach them to want toys, but they still have the desire to chase hardwired. And so the rapidly retreating object that I am desperate to hold onto and possess becomes such a big deal to them. And his name is Felix, by the way. And working really, really hard to have Carson not be the same with him. I'll talk to you all about it in like 2 years if I've got it figured out with her, because I don't have it figured out today. But okay, so we have these dogs who, well, also, can we acknowledge too that there are plenty of very lovely pet dogs who can go to the park and play chuck it for a few throws and have it not be a problem at all, and then get leashed up and head home.
Oh, yeah.
And like, those dogs exist. Those dogs are wonderful. Want more of those dogs for people. They're usually designed intentionally. These dogs were not made for work. If they were made for work, it's service work. Like, they're more that sort of temperament. We've got our bench line Goldens and Labs. A lot of times are just perfectly fine to do this. I'm going to get canceled for saying this phrase, but I believe it strongly. Your well-bred doodles are going to be perfectly happy to do this. Like, it's that type of dogs, lots of mixed breed dogs. It's probably not going to be your border collie. It's probably not going to be your GSP. Certainly not going to be the dogs that we've talked about a lot lately, like your more obscure Munsterlander types.
Even with those dogs, the question that I always have is it worth it because of the high rate of injury?
Yeah.
And so, like, there's a reason when you talk to sports medicine vets, they are like, you could not do that. Rehab vets, like, there's a reason a lot of dogs who play a lot of fetch will have arthritis. And then again, you spend time in these kinds of spaces in like the rehab world and then also in retriever land. You start to hear about the things like the dog who impales themselves.
Oh, yeah.
The dog who shatters a leg, who breaks their back. And so even in the case of the dogs who are not, you know, flying through the ceiling, I just go like, we've got a lot of better games that we could be doing.
So, right. So like, you know, I was driving through a kind of higher end Seattle suburb the other day. Cute little, just right in the middle of the city park with, I think it was like two doodles and then couple other, like, it was funny that it was like all doodles and then also dog breeds you don't see. Like there was like a Landseer Newfoundland and and I'm blanking now, but like it was funny to me that there was like, I was like, oh, all of these like child-free rich white people that have their doodles and their dogs, yeah, their whatever. Anyway, yeah, like the sweet little doodle playing Chuck It in that park, probably fine, but oh my gosh, if that doodle had like a couple of skills, could be more fine, could be safer in his body. That's, you know, essentially, even if this is not damaging.
And we could put that effort into.
Even if it's not damaging to this dog's mind, which it's not damaging to all of their minds, there are ways for us to make it less damaging to their body as well.
Yes. And my kind of thing that I kind of come back to a lot when I get these like, but my Cavalier King Charles loves this is, and you could be using that time to get you further with what you want to
do. So the hill that I know that both of us will die on is the hill of skills. Skill training, teaching the dog actual skills is the, we've talked about this. It is what divides the training field, in my opinion. Like folks who are getting really good results, regardless of methodology or style, are teaching dog skills. Folks who maybe are not are, I think, not teaching as many skills.
And if you think that you're not, and you are getting good results, I promise
then
you probably are.
Then you probably are. And so teaching dogs some skills around the game of fetch kind of turns it into a retrieve type of situation. It's saying I'm going to train this dog to retrieve versus I'm going to become the machine that spits a ball out when the dog puts it. It's turning you from a fly ball box into an actual being that has a relationship with this animal and is communicating with this animal. So you're the retriever person on this call. What are these skills that we can talk about?
Yeah. So basically it's endless. Like the level of difficulty of this that you can come to and complexity is pretty much endless, which is great because one of the things that I'm sure you hear a lot, maybe before, maybe you don't get it as often as you used to, but they're like, oh yeah, we train every single day. And what it is we run through the same five behaviors that the dog knows, and then they get a milk bone and then they're done.
Sure.
That's not dog training. And variety is what gets you where you want to go, right? That's engaging their brains, moving their bodies in different ways even, right? Getting them off a flat surface, getting them into down to ditches, over logs, all of that stuff, great for them. And so a really, really basic retrieve is a chain. And if we look at it from like a sort of gun dog skill, and it's pretty similar to what we'll see in like obedience and stuff like that, is they mark it. So they stare at where it is. On cue, they run to it, pick it up, bring it back, and deliver it in the way that has been specified. So either in front of you to hand, beside you, or you could have them put it down somewhere if you don't want to have to pick it up. From there, the complexities become vast. So do they have to search for it? Do they have to hunt? Did they see where it fell? Did they see where it fell and then walk 20 feet away and have to go back and search for it? Did they not see where it was? Did we go out, lay it, then get the dog out of the car, point them in the right direction, and send them out to use their brains? Do we teach all those prerequisite skills so that they're able to do that without finding that frustrating and difficult? There's so much you can do with it. And that's not even like, and then you have the environment. It's like, can they go over something to get the toy? Can they go climb over a fallen log? If there is a mowed section and then a ditch with a whole bunch of high cover, high grass, and then more mowed section, can they, if they've been good at hunt searching in that cover, can they go past it to where it actually fell and like pay attention to what their brain was telling them and not what their past experiences is suggesting might happen? Like there's so much complexity, and now we can play with it. We can make it different every day. We can ask them to do doubles, triples, watch three of them fall, and then get them on individual cues as directed by you. There's so much complexity that you can play with and have fun with once you get those basics down.
Yeah. And there's even, if you're going, oh, this is, I don't know anything about this. I can't be this creative. Like there's a new AKC titling game called Fetch. And I went and like, I was curious about it. So I went and looked at all the rules and like, sure, you're the basic like first and second levels are like kind of boring, but it gets cool. Like it gets interesting. It gets harder. And you could literally just go look at the rules for those games and progressively like start with the novice level because it is very easy. And if the dog can go out and pick up a thing and bring it to you, you got it. And then progress all the way to the top levels where there are three of them. They're behind blinds. You have to direct the dog which one to go, and then you have to send the dog to another one. Like that's the kind of stuff you're talking about. It's outlined for you in a way that's not retriever, like not hunting retriever type of training. Like it's just outlined for fun. Yeah,
you don't
actually
have to
have dead birds the way that some people on this call have dead birds in their freezer.
And like, I do have a webinar on how to do this because I think this is worthwhile for a lot of these dogs. Like I do want people to play these games.
Yeah.
Right. Like I actually think this is really beneficial, but I also do other ones.
Like teaching them
especially
to find
the, it's the combo.
The thing with their nose. I mean, getting the dog scenting instead of visually tracking is putting them in a completely different mindset, a completely different state of like, if you think fetch is something you can't live without because this dog will just drive you nuts, teach them to find the thing that you threw in a patch of bushes or whatever.
And how much do we want our young, big feelings dogs to learn that they can have a really big feeling about something and then
which is exactly what they're doing when they watch you toss or plant a toy that they feel a lot about, and then you send them for it and they have to engage their nose to find it. And I would say, because I have done this with Felix, and so if they can find it with their eyeballs, they will not calm themselves down enough and they will find it with their eyeballs. So you really have to get clever about hiding it so that they do find it with their nose. And just have a look at their body and the difference between what they're doing when they're visually tracking and what they're doing when they're scenting. And you will see what I mean, because they go from stiff and rigid and frantic in their motions to just S curves. And like their tail is moving in these big fluid motions. Like why do tails move like that when the dog's nose is working? I don't know, but it is universal. It's so universal.
Cool. Yeah. But it doesn't even need to, like, you can do stuff inside as well. So one of my favorite games that I play with my retriever Biscuit, when I don't have any energy to go and do big things with him, is he brings me one of those toys that comes with little toys inside of it that they can pull out. So he brings me an empty one. And then I'm like, can you find me more? And then he goes to his toy box and he brings me more. And I'm like, hey, and another one, and another one, and another one. He brings me a whole bunch of toys. And then I stuff all those toys in the first toy. And then he gets to pull it apart.
That's so cute.
That is retrieving. It's so
really
cute.
Highly enriching mental game to play for sure. So marking, retrieving, the hunting, searching portion, another really cool skill to teach the dog. We also want to teach the dog how to move away from the toy. I think that that might feel impossible. Like if your dog is really sticky about toys, it's going to feel impossible. It's going to be so worthwhile to teach them. I'm working on returning to this split right now for Felix with his dumbbell retrieve, because even though I tried really hard not to have him think the dumbbell for competitive obedience was a toy, he believes that it is because I throw it and he gets to hold it in his mouth. So what it, of course it is.
Close enough.
And so I'm working really hard on this ability to dismiss it, to move away from it. It's hard for him. And it's a really beautiful thing when I see it actually happen, like when his body and mind let it go.
And just like the dog that is actively trying to crawl inside of a treat pouch is not in an ideal headspace to be training, a dog that is gravitating and being pulled towards and constantly pushing into a toy is not in the right headspace. Like that is a prerequisite skill that they need to have before they can actually do any skills around the toy. They need to know how to access. You don't access it by hurling yourself at it.
And if they've already learned that they do access it that way, you're in for it. It's not going to be easy for you to undo.
No, it's hard.
You might need help from Liza, for instance, to get that done. And on the flip side of that coin, I think is the behavior of just teaching them when they actually get to access the thing. Like the cue that means go get it.
Yes.
Or bite it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And these can be...
This means... It, just like you would a marker. Just like it's like it is a marker. It's just it's you take reinforcement now, right? So, and I've got a couple for my dog. Obviously, we always keep those as simple as you can.
For sure.
But they need it to, can they be, need to know.
And also basically when you have one or two of them trained really nicely, then you get to teach more if it looks like more are going to be workable for you. Like teaching get it off the ground versus get it from my hand is kind of where I begin. And then I do teach them, although then I don't use it, a word that means chase it, like I'm throwing it now. That tends to be a big explosion of arousal, mm-hmm. so it tends not to be something that then winds up happening in my practice. It's funny, I taught it to Felix, and I just probably won't teach it to Carson. And then finally, like if they can move away from it and they understand when they can get it, now you can look for them to offer behaviors to access it, because they already are offering behaviors to access it. They're just behaviors that you don't like. Like they're screaming at you.
See, that's what I was about to say. They're already doing the thing.
Well, that's why we have these conversations, because we're thinking the same thing. Like they are, like they're already doing that. They're screaming at you. They're throwing their body at you. If they're the border collie, they are pushing it towards you and staring really hard. And then they push it towards you again and stare harder mm-hmm. after that. And some border collie is really, really good at putting it in your cup that you're holding just to make sure that you saw it. Yeah. Just to make sure that
that's
you
great. Got it. Yeah. I get things just delivered to me constantly.
I bet.
It's like you could throw
as this. A suggestion.
Yeah, I know.
This
I know
is
that's
throwable.
The thing that could happen.
So they're already doing that.
My border collie used to put it in front of your foot mm-hmm. so you'd accidentally
kick
it.
For sure. Yeah, a border collie that I used to live with was so good at that. So good at just setting it right where you will kick it when you move. So they're already doing it. In order for you so they already know how to do this. You just want different behaviors. So that's going to require really splitting down and finding approximations of other behaviors. If you've taught them to do this for food, it's an easier transition to doing it for toys. Like if your dog understands the concept of person has reinforcer, person has made themselves available to me, I could offer eye contact, I could offer a sit, etc. It'll be easier to do with a toy mm-hmm. because they already have kind of more of that. They have that skill. It's just that they don't know that it's possible with the toy. They don't know that those behaviors will pay off with a toy.
And then you also need to have skills.
How terrible.
As a handler. This is the hard part, is that like using a check it stick is exceptionally easy and you can do it while on your phone. And where I see a lot of problems in the dogs that show up in my inbox is things like the reinforcer is holding the toy. So ending the game is a massive, massive punishment.
Yeah.
Trying to move to the next rep of behavior because the dog doesn't know how to finish holding the thing and hand it over without the thing being taken.
Mm-hmm.
That's bad. If you can't get the thing back without taking it, it's a huge problem. And we so want to take all of their stuff all of the time. I have rules for Biscuit, like things that are bird-shaped and bumper-shaped, you don't get to keep. Balls, do whatever you want. You let me know when you're ready. You can pee with the ball. You can hold the ball as long as you want. You can lie there and squish, 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 squish. There's a reason I don't give him balls to squeak.
Yeah.
And then he will tell me when he's ready to do the next set. If you don't have that, everything else will fall.
Yeah, because unfortunately, nobody likes this to be true, but unfortunately, resource guarding is in this. A lot of these behaviors that people believe are, well, dog just really likes that toy. Like, yeah, sure, they do. And also, they don't want you
and
to take
it,
which is the basis of resource guarding, if of any kind.
Yeah. So I consider retrieving and feeling, like, especially the retrieves that are, they come out of the box. Like, not something that we, you know, like, I never successfully got my rough collie Percy to, like, actually retrieve anything, because I really try that hard because I don't care. But, like, he did not arrive with retrieving feelings, but Biscuit sure did.
Right. And
all my
what define that,
and that is on the same
define
spectrum
that. Like wanting to hold.
So they just offer picking things up and holding them and carrying them. I have a video from the first night that I had Biscuit at home where he picks up a little squeaky duck toy because I'm morally obligated to buy every plushy duck ever. And just he picks it up and he runs through the house with it.
Right.
Now that's not flying across the room to take someone's face off, but it is on that spectrum of having a feeling mm-hmm. about holding and having, you know, quote unquote ownership mm-hmm. of a thing. Now that works great for me because I taught him what to do with that thing in mm-hmm. order to get reinforcement. And that in doing that, he can right. have more things, and that works great. And so he's like, this is awesome. I have really big feelings about picking the stuff I'm carrying around, and I know how to make it work for me. That's great. But this can become a massive problem elsewhere if they're not given an appropriate outlet for it. And really, especially if they arrive with those feelings and they do normal things that they're expected to do, and then everybody panics and takes all their stuff away or insists on grabbing their stuff and throwing it all the time because they think they want to play fetch because they brought you a toy, or, you know, takes all the sticks and twigs out of their mouth and steals their pine cones and tries to trade them for the used needle that they picked up for cheese. And then gets really upset when they won't immediately switch to eating cheese because they found this really cool used noodle and it's awesome. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So like we can drive this car off the cliff very, very quickly. And we do often. And a lot of the protocols that we have as R plus dog trainers are not helpful for these kinds of feelings when it comes to guarding. And we often miss these early signs because they look like play. So this is all wrapped up in guarding.
Yeah. And again, like I want to emphasize that's okay. Like we're not saying this is a problem.
Yeah, it works great.
We've selected for it and we like it and we're not trying to get rid of it. But recognizing what it truly helps you to be smarter about the choices that you make when you're training it.
This is so far from a problem that I have a dog who was in a lineup at a store and someone dropped their wallet and he picked it up and he gave it to them. That's the opposite of, that's the cutest thing that has ever happened. This dog picked up a mocha. I don't know where he got it from, a full mocha, and brought it to me. And it was going everywhere. And he was like, I think I can trade this for a kibble. Like this is the opposite of a problem.
Right.
But it is on that spectrum of having big feelings about
owning. And so plenty of dogs really just want to hold stuff. They don't actually want you to throw it. And that's something that we just want to put in people's heads as a possibility that maybe the dog actually just wants to parade around with it a little bit more and you don't need to be throwing it across the park all the time. Yeah. Stop like let them stuff. Offer to give it to like the dog that is spitting it at you and then starting the run again because they're expecting you to throw it again. Like that dog's not possessing the thing. The dog that you have to argue with and like rip it out of their mouth to throw it again, like that they are. This is simple.
And the dog like runs and grabs it and holds it. Like there's such there's a difference in the difference in the hold behavior as well. When they like grab it and they're like, oh, I got it. It's mine now. And I'm like, yeah, you didn't want me to do that, did you? Sorry.
So I think that's kind of one kind of myth is that dogs universally like this. They don't. And plenty of dogs who like toys.
They don't.
Don't want you to throw the toys because they actually just want to hold it, or they might want to tug. Like there's just other ways to engage. And then another myth we kind of want to bust is just safety, and I think we already did. Like there's physical safety risks here,
chronic and acute injuries, chronic spine impact, chronic shoulder, elbow, those sudden stops and turns. Like man, I've got some epic videos of this bit wiping out doing.
Yeah, just and it's chasing to be very clear, like I'm good with having dogs do lots of big physical stuff with their bodies. Like I'm not interested in keeping them safely bubble wrapped and on a couch. I play dog agility for God's sake. There's a high rate of injury in that sport. I do off-leash hiking. Lots of injuries happen off-leash hiking. I'm trying to not do chronic repetitive stress stuff in a general sense. I don't throw things repeatedly and have the dog slam on their body as they go and retrieve it. And I also don't do like 20 reps of the A-frame to try to like, I try to do most of my training on the flat. Like I, in everything that I'm doing, I'm trying to minimize the impact on their body. And that's why going and just playing repetitive back and forth fetch is simply not going to be in my practice, even if I had one of those lovely dogs who was totally fine with it. Unfortunately, a lot of those lovely dogs also have a genetic predisposition to CCL tears. And so, like, you want to be keeping them safe as best as you can. And unfortunately, this is a thing. And so it's not safe. And I think that safety is relative, and I'm not only interested in safe things, but I want to make sure that everybody's aware that, like, it isn't inherently safe.
Yeah. And for me, it's always a cost benefit analysis here. Like, months ago, someone asked me if I was worried about my dogs swimming in the ocean where there's orcas. And I was like, well, now
that,
I am.
That might have been Why didn't you say that? It worries me. Or like, I was at a waterfront, like, and I was going to let Felix get in the water, and here comes a sea lion just right. And I was like, never mind. Yeah, and like, I've had plenty of seals, less concerned about harbor seals, would like to just kind of, I'd like to leave them alone. They'd like to leave us alone. A sea lion will murder.
Yeah. See, your, Biscuit okay, doesn't want to leave harbor seals alone.
That is a problem.
He's like, oh,
once I thought a blue pit bull was swimming over to my dogs, but it was a seal. I was like, where did this pity come from?
But like, that's the kind of thing where I'm like, the likelihood of that happening is excruciatingly low. And like, obviously, like, oh, it's probably fine. Whereas, you know, I do use free throws as a reinforcer for Biscuit. He gets maybe max 5 a week. So like, yeah, he does get to chase a thing and slam his body into it. Not very often. We don't even do it like every week. And I certainly don't do it more than a few times on, you know, either a walk or in a training session. And I use it for a reason. Yeah. And I've thought through
all
these.
Right. You're saying this is not a benign thing for me to do. And so I'm going to make sure that the maximum benefit comes with it every time that I do it.
Yes. And it's definitely, and it is not repetitive. So like, again, he gets to keep a ball. So if he gets a free throw, he has a specific marker cue. If he retrieves something, he doesn't get that thing thrown for him usually. He gets a ball, so mm-hmm. he has to switch out, which is really hard for him. Or something like a stop whistle, I'll throw a ball behind him to move him back, get that explosive action, and get also give him more access to the environment. He then gets to keep the thing. So sometimes he comes back to me and is like, do you want to do it again? And I'm like, yeah, I'll like kick it a foot, sure. Or we'll play with it. Or we'll run around in circles. Or he just like goes and has a sniff and like hangs out. Or he brings it back and he rolls on it. And then we're like, okay, now are we ready to do the next rep? Just like we would with any training session.
So it's like
that pause.
It's a reinforcement scenario for you that you then throw a ball. And then he is allowed to do whatever he wants to with said ball until he's ready to re-engage the next loop, basically. It is one of those, this isn't efficient. You aren't getting a lot of reps in your training when you use a reinforcer like this, but it is sometimes really, really worthwhile to use an inefficient reinforcer and get just the bang for your buck on the behavior rather than reps. Like, it's sometimes that's the best option. Depends on what you're doing.
Yeah. And there, it's usually with, like, usually when I'm using something like that, it's when there's another thing that he would prefer to be holding. And it's with a very long loop. And this is the dog who is not allowed chukkis. So fully on the list of, you know, not for Biscuit is chukkis. I would argue not for duck tollers, which is going to make people really sad. But both with their brains and their backs, not for duck. And he has a history of his brain melting and coming out of his ears when there's a potential for chukkit happening. And I have never once played chukkit with this dog. He's played a couple of times with other people. There have been conversations about that. And he knows that other dogs get to play chukkit. And yet I had to do an entire desensitization protocol for a chukkit stick just for using it for one specific.
Mm-hmm. That would happen to me if I did something like that with Felix. He's never seen nor heard of a chukkit intentionally. So here's something. People throw this one at you on Instagram. I've seen it. And so we're just going to bust it right here, right now. People say there's no evidence that this causes behavior problems, that any kind of repetitive fetch causes behavior problems. They go, where's your evidence? Mm-hmm. So where is it, Liza?
It's my research study, Sarah. Go ahead. it's my inbox. And it's 20 years of working with gun dogs, guys. So the fact is like we just do not have research on this. I'm not sure how we would get good research on this either. Like, that would be quite a project, which I'd be very interested in if someone wants to do it. But it is not something that we currently have any data on either way. We don't have research that it's good for them. We don't have research that it's neutral.
Right. And that is true of a lot of things.
But what I do,
that's just the truth. Yeah.
A lot of things. So we're doing our best with the information that we have and using our best critical thinking skills and trying to connect the dots between other things that we do have information on. And there's two sort of things that I see that really inform this opinion, or there's three, actually, there's three things. First of all, I look at the dogs. So I've been told that I can't tell that my dog has an adrenaline spike when he sees a check-in. I actually can look at my dog because he's right in front of me and I know him really, really well. And I know all of his relatives and have for 20 years. And I absolutely promise you that all of those stress hormones just went through the roof because his heart rate changed, which I can tell by, like, if I touch him at all, I can feel that shift in his body. His breathing change. His muscles have all tensed. He has moved from being comfortably on his feet to positioning himself for forward action. His pupils have dilated.
Yeah, there's so many ways you can tell. Like, honestly, the entirety of the worked up course is like learning to observe your dog better and respond. Like, we can tell.
Yes, we can tell. And then the next one is my inbox, which is constant. My inbox
is full of gun dogs who are playing repetitive fetch, just period.
It's full of gun dogs, and a lot of them play, and a lot of dogs who, and like not even a lot of repetitive fetch. Like, we played fetch with him for a few weeks a year ago, and then realized it was a bad idea, and now this is still a problem. Finding toys on walks, stealing things and hiding them in the garden and then guarding them, swallowing them, screaming and shredding them. Unable to eat food or drink water while holding them. That's Biscuit. Biscuit has a system to put the toy down so that he can drink water. That is how big his feelings are. When we talk about, you know, when they lie down to be exhausted and put the toy down, I'm talking about a dog that I had to teach a system so that he could drink water on a hot day. It's pretty extreme.
It's pretty dumb.
I get this constantly. And like, that's pretty obviously a problem. And then the other one is then what we happen when we change the picture. So the amount of times that I have had dogs where we have changed either fetch at all, and then also how we interact with toys. And then something happens, like your father-in-law comes over and throws the ball for the dog. And every other behavior problem that we've been working on is worse for 3 days. That's happened just enough times that it's pretty clear that that is part of the picture.
Sure. So certainly a correlate. Like, it may not be causal, but it is a correlate, yes, for sure. Yeah.
It's so part of the picture, and like exactly the part, that's something we're going to have to delve into over time.
And you and I are going to talk a little bit about some cases in a second here. So we'll get into kind of my realization that it was a problem with a specific case that I had. But the last kind of myth that we want to bust here is that this is meeting some kind of niche need for these specific dogs. That, like, if you have a hunt point retrieve type, you have to be throwing the ball for them or you're not serving them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're not doing the thing, which is baffling to me because I see this actually more with the HPRs than I do with the retrievers. And
sure
their
does.
Job looks less like that than the retrievers do. Fetch is not quartering. Fetch is not staying steady on the line. It's not walk-ups. It's not trained holds. It's not pointing. It's not flushing. And it's also
not the same
not
type.
Actually
yeah.
retrieving because it's, yeah. they're not putting the thing, right? They're not putting the yeah. thing in a specific place. They're the only similarity is that they're running to the thing and getting it, which a lot of HPRs, depending on where you're doing it, do very, very little of.
So interesting that the retriever folks don't usually say this. Do you feel like that's because you get less of those folks in your inbox, period? Or do you think that it is maybe those people are struggling with their dogs less? Like, the HPRs are difficult for people, and so they maybe are trying to make this dog less difficult by playing fetch, and then you hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there was a bigger population of Chessies in pet homes, that I'd probably hear a lot more from them.
Thank God there's not. Said with love.
Said with
love. Thank God there's not.
Said with love. Thank God there's not.
I had a few Chessie clients early in my career. That dog is no joke. That's not a Labrador. That is not a, yeah, it's not
no,
a Labrador.
No, they're hardcore.
All right, so we're going to dig into it. People have listened to this podcast for a long time, which it's old at this point. It's going on 8 years of age. So if you listened all the way at the beginning, I did a case study on a golden retriever named Jade. And if you haven't listened to that one, it's a good one. You can go back and check it out. It's a 3-part series on a golden named Jade. And Jade was really pivotal for me on the exercise front and on the decompression type exercise front. Because he is, I almost said was, but he's still alive. He is a field/sport type golden retriever who is extremely intense. And he was living in a city with his person who would get home from school. And she was in college, undergrad at the time. And she would put him on a gentle leader and like a short traffic lead and walk him to the park. And then she would throw the chuck it until his tongue was huge and he was flopping over on his side. Exactly what we just talked about. Like until he was physically fatigued, she would do that. And then she would put him back on that short leash and walk him home. And the short leash is because he had some dog directed aggression problems. Like he was just no joke of a dog. And he was pretty safe in the park when he was fetching. Like he wasn't going to disengage from fetching the ball to go have a problem with the dog. So that was also a way that she could get him that outlet without having him have an interaction that was problematic. Unless the dog like came and tried to take his ball, which like did happen and does happen when you're in parks. And this is a real thing. When she actually came to me for help in agility because he was really brutalizing her. I mean, he was biting her and slamming it. I mean, he was really giving her a hard time. And there's a lot of things that I would do differently about Jade now. But when I heard about this, my instinct was, and I had already been using the term decompression walks. And this was well over 10 years, or was it 10 years ago? How old's Jade? He's an older guy. So a decade-ish ago is what we're talking about. And I was using that term and I believed how important it was. And so I was telling her to do that. And then I also dug into the fetch front with her and was like, you gotta also quit that. Like, that's not a thing for you anymore. You are going to drive into the mountains and you are going to have him run off leash. That's what you're going to do for his exercise. And his world really changed. And hers did too. She's now like this crazy avid hiker. And like, it's very, very cool to see that that's her life now. And he, because of him, I felt really strongly that like fetch was a no and was bad for all dogs. And like, just, that's why I haven't, you know, done any kind of fetch type of stuff like that with any of my personal dogs for so long. And it's interesting because I will sometimes prescribe in my behavior work what I shorten it to HIE. It is high intensity exercise. I will have people engage in high intensity exercise with their dogs if the case seems like it calls for it. And sometimes the only accessible way for them to do that is to throw a thing repetitively. Still, I'm putting skills in it every time. Like I'm not saying just go do that thing, but I'm putting skills in it. But so the way that my kind of thinking has shifted is that, you know, if I had Jade today, I would have done some kind of high intensity exercise with him, as well as the decompression hiking off leash. And I think that those two things together would have been better, as well as a lot of other things that I could have done differently and better for him. But, you know, we all grow. But for him, it may have been like a treadmill. It may not have been throwing a ball. Like the feelings that he had already developed over the chuck it situation would have pretty much put that out the window. I wouldn't have tried to fix that. I would have just said, that's not a thing for him anymore. But he probably does need to run next to your bike or pull your bike or be on a treadmill or something like that. Because a lot of these dogs do actually require really high intensity energy outlets in order for them to access decompression. And I think that that's what people are trying to do a lot of the time, is they're trying to get them calm enough that they can then go on a sniffy walk, because they can't even go on a sniffy walk. So for me now, I really acknowledge Well, first of all, I'm softer and nicer to people than I was. And so I'm less rude about people playing fetch with their dogs. Less dogmatic about everything, I would say. And, but also I would have dug deeper as far as like, what can we replace this with rather than just, you're going to replace it with hiking. And so that's kind of my shifted thinking on that. But truly getting rid of that in his life was pivotal for him. Only getting rid of that wouldn't have done anything. It was getting rid of that. And then also he's going into the mountains and he's running. And I mean, I started having her hike him off leash before agility lessons. It made a huge difference in what he was able to do there at the lesson. We stopped using toys in agility. He was the first dog of my clientele that I ever said, Tug is not serving you. You're not going to play it anymore. Because this dog's possession was no joke. And now we think about the Chuck It that she was playing and the severe possession he had. And I'm going, so not only was he having this enormous adrenaline spike every time you threw it, he was having an enormous wash of other not good feelings every time you took it. And then you threw it away. I mean, just, yes, like I'm going to say he didn't love fetch the way that people think. He probably was angered every single time she threw it.
Yeah.
But I mean, this dog ran on anger, so he did great with it. And so we got rid of toys in general. Today I would reform their toy play and would have potentially talked further about it, but we just got rid of them at that time. So that's kind of the dog that was pivotal for me in my thinking on this. I'm going to have you jump in now and talk about some dogs that you want to talk about and kind of what you've learned from them.
Yeah. And it was when we first talked about doing this, like, it's kind of hard to narrow down who to talk about mm-hmm. because this is most of my cases. There's an element of this in most of them, whether it's stealing objects, eating objects, fetch related stuff. Toy play related stuff in dog training. Toy play stuff that has destroyed all dog training as a concept, not just this toy. It can get really bad really fast. But, and I know, like, we've talked about this before, because I agree with you with the breaking things down into component pieces. So, you know, I've talked about there are times when Biscuit needs to go hard and fast, and that's part of his care needs. So Biscuit really is a little, like, decompression walk success story, because until I had him, every single one of my Dachshunders and my two Border Collies were fetch-obsessed goblins. And getting him out and switching how we were walking dramatically changed his behavior, to the point that now, however many years later, 4-something years later, the spots that we used to walk where he got to chase toys, he screams, even if we haven't been there 4 months. He screams when we pass them on the highway. Whereas he will whine and cry in the car under specific circumstances for other places, but it is incredibly consistent with these places that he got to go and do a lot of chase and fetch. Switching out a lot of that for just leaving him the F alone was a dramatic shift in his behavior really quickly. The component piece that I didn't realize was also happening was that at that time I was doing a lot of dog training with him, like a lot. We were doing retrieving work, we did KPA together, like we were doing all sorts of online classes. And when those things stopped, like when I finished KPA, I gave him a break, and he went through the roof. He was insufferable. And of course, reinforcement, I was like, oh, he needs more decompression walks. So we did more decompression walks, we did more hiking. That did not work.
Because you were already doing that part. That now, part was there.
When we started having...
No, he didn't.
Was doing that he, point. He didn't need more. Well, what he needed was I call it
calculus.
He was also partying hard.
Like the training he needed to do. What I say about my Border Collies is they need to move their bodies fast and hard, like you said. They need to decompress and find the zen and be sniffy and doggy. And they also need to do calculus. Mm-hmm.
They do. It's a requirement. And I don't know if you remember this. You probably don't. But it was years and years and years ago in a webinar version of Workout. I asked about this dog arriving at the walking spot. And you said, it's probably not decompressing for him.
I don't remember that, but it sounds like something I would say.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, correct. And this is something like we talked about this like at length in the membership about how to piece these things apart and teach these young gun dogs to actually calm themselves down, because that's not a thing that comes installed, because they want to be going so hard and fast all the time. But those things need to happen. The hard and fast needs to happen as well. So Biscuit does come from a line of just a lot of ball obsessed dogs, like a lot of really stereotypic behavior around balls, a lot of screaming, just meltdown over arousal all the time with balls. And because of that, I was semi-conscious of it for the first 3 year bit of his life, and then really starting to dive into why he wasn't decompressing on locks at all. Then I started actually teaching him how to retrieve and using that as a tool to meet his needs, not just as a behavior that we were teaching for my purposes. And that's been a massive game changer for him because of the nature of those complex skills. I can change them to get what I want out of him and to give him what he needs on any given day. So one of the things we talked about is like getting their energy out. I think we've both called it being full of bees when they are just buzzing. And my preferred way to get them release the bees is to do some memory searches in really, really high cover for a thing that he can rip open.
So not a thing he's expected to bring back to you, a thing that he rips open and eats something out of himself. That's great.
Which is, by the way, on a separate marker cue, so he knows which one it is.
It's like a separate search. Like, it's a you are looking for this now. Go look for it. Okay.
Yeah. The thing, it's like with his marker for free throw. If I say free, I'm throwing the toy that was in play already. And if I say ball, I'm throwing a ball. Like, he's that sharp. He's that fast. So if I say kill it, I'm throwing something that means you're going to get to rip it open and eat what's inside. So because of all of those things, I can very accurately meet his needs. And it's been just like a dramatic shift in how I take care of him and how livable he is to be with. And then that's something that I do with most of the dogs that I work with. And that's how we came up with the understanding exercise thing. And that's how we work with all the toy obsession is skills. And then figuring out what specific needs are and how to meet them effectively, instead of just sort of throwing past at the wall and hoping that it sticks.
I love that game. I'm sitting here thinking about Felix and feeling like he would still just bring it to me.
But if it was like a breakfast sandwich.
Well, maybe not.
In a bag?
He wouldn't bring that to me, no.
Yeah.
No. I'm wondering if he would search for it with the same... I know he wouldn't search for it with the same kind of intensity that he would search for a toy. But maybe that's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we got to jam on this because now I'm curious. I want to find out. But actually, a really interesting thing to note is once I did this with Biscuit, because he had a really kind of weird interaction with the dog on a trail, and I could see that he was just sort of like, icky feeling afterwards. And then he went and grabbed a stick and started shredding a stick. And I was like, huh. And I had a rabbit's fur lotus ball in my pocket, because obviously. And I brought him over to a field and I said, kill it. And I threw it and he went and got it and he brought it back. And I was like, okay, kill it, threw it.
Okay.
He gets it. He shreds it. He gets the food. He brings it back. He will bring it back. I will reload it for him if he brings it back. That's our little system. And so he was too amped to do the behavior that was asked of him that he knows on cue. And so we had to, in that instance, chose to do it again.
Sure. I think part of it for Felix is that he doesn't know anything about a lotus ball. So I'd have to teach him that first. But it could just be food. Yeah, it could just be food.
I did teach Biscuit the lotus ball.
Sure.
I use a meatball a lot with the dogs when people are really emotionally invested in fetch, and it's like a really hard song.
You know what I do?
I just have them throw meatballs.
A split for competitive obedience, which Felix's competitive obedience feelings are a whole other Oprah. Like, it's a lot because of his feelings about the dumbbell. So a split for me is to throw a large piece of food in the retrieve scenarios. So I throw it, I do a flat retrieve
something
and I
dense.
Do a retrieve over the high jump for just a large chunk of something that he can easily see. So he goes out, he goes over the jump, he eats it, he comes back over the jump, he does a front, he does a finish. Like, he does the entire chain, he's just not fetching. And that's just to remove the dumbbell feelings about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those picking up things up and holding things feelings, as we've discussed, they're huge, they're hard.
Yeah, and the possession feelings of the dumbbell that he very certainly has that in the ring. He almost never does this in training, but in the ring a few times I've gone to take the dumbbell and he has actually clamped and growled. Sweetheart.
Because the reinforcement.
Like, well, and he knows I'm going to take it and give it to the judge. He knows I'm going to take it and give it to the judge.
He knows you're going
to
take it. So, like, I have a dog right now in the program who was trying really, really hard to do a certain retrieve system. And we realized that the reinforcer at play was not the food that was being offered. It was possession of the toy. And as soon as we've started switching him. But as soon as we went, like, well, if you put it down, you get more toy.
Yeah.
He was like, oh. Yeah.
That's where.
Oh, okay. Like, I can do
what this. I'm working on now is that I have a secret dumbbell stuffed in my vest. And that he gets to have that one after he lets me give the one to back to the judge is kind of one of the many little things that I'm working on. But do you have any other kind of stories that you think we need to touch on before we wrap up? Because I know you have so many, so many, but maybe pick a couple or one. We'll see.
Yeah. So just to boil down several into one general circumstance, one of the ones that I get a lot is that a lot of fetch and that dog going back for more and more and more and more and then coming home and being through the roof. And that's often coupled with not
sleeping. And they're going, why? I'm giving him so much exercise.
And I'm giving him so much exercise. And so my protocol for that is very often we remove the chasing of a toy entirely. We also will then start teaching sleep using just the antecedent arrangements. If whoever is going to be at Expo, I'm really looking forward to hearing Kiki Yablon talk about this because I don't know what she's going to say, but I know she's going to talk about it. And I'm really excited. Teaching resting without adding food, because as we all know that if you just teach them to lay on a mat, they are really good at laying on a mat and they are not
happy creating, well. For instance. That's why there's no food in happy crating. It is all antecedent arrangement to produce rest. Yeah.
Again, they have two big feelings about their reinforcers. So often when we swap that out and then start teaching that rest, we get an entirely different behavior picture. It is not the solution for a lot of the behaviors that we're getting, which are like barky, lungy stuff and being really frenetic and frantic all the time. But it is the very first thing that needs to happen. The other thing that I do a lot with different dogs is teaching them to tell us how they'd like to play and then just listening to them.
What a concept.
And it turns out they very frequently do not want us to tug anything. They very frequently do not want us to throw their stuff. The thing that I love probably more than most things in the world is the spaniel party that they'll do where they want to show you this thing that they have and it's so amazing, this wonderful treasure, and they will come over and if you don't try to take it, they'll show you the game. Which is like Biscuit's version is to be on his back, getting his tummy rubbed while he holds the thing. A lot of them will do like little loops around you and around other people. And they're showing off this treasure that they have. They will like shove it at you and they're like, look at it. I've got one dog who will come and sit on his mom's lap with a toy. And that's what he wants to do is he wants to sit on her and have his shoulders rubbed. Like, he wants to share having the thing. He doesn't want her to. And this is a dog with pretty serious resource guarding history. He doesn't want her to have it, but he wants to bring stuff to her. And so when we let them tell us what they actually want to do, it opens up just a huge relationship building thing and also really interesting opportunities for reinforcement.
And I think that that's the perfect little little period at the end of the sentence is just try to listen to them. Try to see what it is that they might actually like. It isn't that fetch made a super athlete and they need more and more fetch. It is that their minds need something different. And we want to fulfill that for them. So to wrap us up, you've mentioned a couple of different webinars that you have just on demand for sale. Like, these aren't things that are coming up. You've just got them on demand and you have bundled them and made a discount for the listeners. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I have three that are relevant. The first one, of course, is understanding exercise, which is what I have all of my BMOD dogs do first. And it really breaks down those sort of, you know, the four steps behavior wellness, those first two, exercise and enrichment. Why do they function? How do they function? How can we use them so that they get us where we want to be? Meeting their movement needs, meeting their brain's needs, all of that effectively and efficiently. We're all tired at this point. And then I have retriever games, which is pretty big compared to the other ones. And it's working through basically like, how do we take those beginner steps of a retrieve, basic training skill, and some beginning field dog training and turn that into a game that can replace fetch and can also replace things like, you know, like a nose word class. Like it's got a lot of those elements of searching and sniffing as well. And how to use things in your environment to give you that difference and different kinds of games to give you different challenges for the dog. Because again, if they're not learning, you're not getting that result. And then I have the newest one, which is Ball is Life. And that is about treating and managing toy obsession in dogs. Mm-hmm. That's what we do all the time, apparently. And it just sort of goes into all of the things like getting them to not obsess over it and harass you constantly if you do have a toy or if a toy exists in the world. I get dogs who will even be obsessed with a dog that is in the garage behind a closed door and in a box because they know it's there. And how to start teaching some skills around those things, like if you have it, what do you do with it, and how to access it without being a pest and without winding through the ceiling. And so there's two sort of bundles. The first is the understanding exercise and Ball's Life, and the second one is all three together, and they're both 10% off.
Cogdog is your discount code, everybody, to grab some of those if you would like. And then I am just going to shamelessly say that Liza is very active in my membership. So if you care to come and join the membership community,
you can come bug me there.
Liza over there and myself, we have really good conversations over there about all of these things and so much more. And that's always linked for you in the notes, but you can also find it just at my website, sarahstrumming.com. Thank you for having this conversation with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you'll rate, review, and subscribe wherever you heard this podcast. And don't forget to join Patreon at patreon.com/cogdogradio. And if you're interested in more content like the stuff you heard here, I hope you'll check out my online courses, my membership, and all of my offerings at my website, sarahstrumming.com. See you there.